They stood at the base of the oak, looking down. Lois was gnawing obsessively on her lower lip. Do we have to go down there, Ralph? Do we really?
Yes.
But why? What are we supposed to do? Take something he stole? Kill him? What?
Other than retrieve Joe's comb and Lois's earrings, he didn't know. But he felt certain he would know, that they both would when the time came.
I think for now we better just keep moving, Lois. The lightning had acted like a strong hand, shoving the tree violently toward the east and opening a large hole at the bottom on its western side. To a man or woman with short-time vision, that hole would undoubtedly look dark and maybe a little scary, with its crumbly sides and barely glimpsed roots squirming in the deep shadows like snakes. But otherwise, not very unusual. A kid with a good imagination might see more, Ralph thought. That dark space at the bottom of the tree might make him think of pirate treasure, outlaw hideouts, trawl holes. But Ralph didn't think even an imaginative short-time kid would have been able to see the dim red glow filtering up from beneath the tree, or realize that those squirming roots were actually rough rungs leading down to some unknown and undoubtedly unpleasant place. No, even an imaginative kid wouldn't see those things. But he or she might sense them. Right. And after doing so, one with any brains would turn and run as if all the demons of hell were in hot pursuit. As would he and Lois, if they had any sense at all. Except for Lois's earrings, except for Joe Wise's comb, except for his own lost place in the purpose, and of course, except for Helen, and possibly Nat, and the 2,000 other people who were going to be at the Civic Center tonight. Lois was right. They were supposed to do something, and if they backed out now, it was a something that would remain forever done, bun, undone. And those are the ropes, he thought. The ropes, the powers that be used to tie us poor, muddled, short-time creatures to their wheel. He now visualized Clotho and Lachesis through a bright lens of hate, and he thought that if the two of them had been here right now, they would have exchanged one of their uneasy looks and then taken a quick step or two away. And they would be right to do that, he thought. Very right. Ralph, what's wrong? Why are you so angry?
He raised her hand to his lips and kissed it.
It's nothing. Come on. Let's go before we lose our nerve.
She looked at him a moment longer, then nodded.
And when Ralph sat down and poked his legs into the gaping, root-lined mouth at the foot of the tree, she was right beside him.
Ralph slid beneath the tree on his back, holding his free hand over his face to keep dirt from crumbling into his open eyes. He tried not to flinch as root knuckles caressed the side of his neck and prodded the small of his back. The smell under the tree was a revolting monkey house aroma that made his gorge rise. He was able to go on kidding himself that he would get used to it, until he was all the way into the hole under the oak, and then the kidding stopped. He raised himself on one elbow, feeling smaller roots digging at his scalp and dangling flaps of bark tickling his cheeks, and ejected as much of his breakfast as still remained in the holding tank. He could hear Lois doing the same thing on his left. A terrible woozy faintness went rolling through his head like a breaking wave. The stench was so thick he was almost eating it, and he could see the red stuff they had followed to this nightmare place under the tree all over his hands and arms. Just looking at this stuff had been bad. Now he found himself taking a bath in it, for God's sake. Something groped for his hand, and he almost gave in to panic before realizing it was Lois. He laced his fingers through hers.
Ralph, come up a little bit. It's better. You can breathe.
He understood what she meant at once, and had to restrain himself, haul himself down at the last moment. If he hadn't, he would have shot up the ladder of perception like a rocket under full thrust. The world wavered, and suddenly there seemed to be a little more light in this stinking hole. And a little more room, too. The smell didn't go away, but it became bearable. Now it was like being in a small closed tent full of people with dirty feet and sweaty armpits. Not nice, but something you could live with, at least for a while. Ralph suddenly imagined the face of a pocket watch, complete with hands that were moving too fast. It was better without the stench trying to pour down his throat and gag him, but this was still a dangerous place to be. Suppose they came out of here tomorrow morning, with nothing left of the Civic Center but a smoking hole on Main Street. And it could happen. Keeping track of time down here, short time, long time, or all time, was impossible. He glanced at his watch, but it was meaningless. He should have set it earlier, but he had forgotten.
Let it go, Ralph. You can't do anything about it, so let it go.
He tried, and as he did, it occurred to him that old Dorr had been 100% correct on the day Ed had crashed into Mr. Westside Gardner's pickup truck. It was better not to mess into long-time business. And yet here they were, the world's oldest Peter Pan and the world's oldest Wendy, sliding under a magic tree into some slimy underworld neither one of them wanted to see. Lois was looking at him, her pale face lit with that sick red glow, her expressive eyes full of fright. He saw dark threads on her chin and realized it was blood. She had quit just nibbling at her lower lip and had begun taking bites out of it.
Ralph, are you all right?
I get to crawl under an old oak tree with a pretty girl and you even have to ask? I'm fine, Lois, but I think we better hurry.
All right.
He felt around below him and placed his foot on a gnarled root knuckle. It took his weight, and he slid down the stony slope, squeezing beneath another root and holding Lois around the waist. Her skirt skidded up to her thighs, and Ralph thought again, briefly, about Chucky Engstrom and his peaky wand. He was both amused and exasperated to see Lois was trying to pull the skirt back down.
I know that a lady tries to keep her skirt down whenever possible, but I think the rule goes by the boards when you're sliding down troll staircases under old oak trees. Okay?
She gave him an embarrassed, frightened little smile.
If I had known what we were going to be doing, I would have worn slacks. I thought we were just going to the hospital.
If I'd known what we were going to be doing, Ralph thought, I would have cashed in my bonds, developing softness in the market or not, and had us on a plane to Rio, my dear.
He felt around with his other foot, very aware that if he fell, he was probably going to end up in a place far beyond the reach of Derry Rescue. Just above his eyes, a reddish worm poked out of the earth, dribbling little crumbles of dirt down on Ralph's forehead. For what seemed like an eternity, he felt nothing, and then his foot found smooth wood, not a root this time, but something like a real step. He slid down, still holding Lois around the waist, and waited to see if the thing he was standing on would hold or snap under their combined weight. It held, and it was wide enough for both of them. Ralph looked down and saw that it was the top step of a narrow staircase which curved down into the red-tinged dark. It had been built for, and perhaps by, a creature that was a lot shorter than they were, making it necessary for them to hunch, but it was still better than the nightmare of the last few moments. Ralph looked at the ragged wedge of daylight above them, his eyes gazing out of his dirt and sweat-streaked face with an expression of dumb longing. Daylight had never looked so sweet or so distant. He turned back to Lois and nodded to her. She squeezed his hand and nodded back. Bending over, cringing each time a dangling root touched their necks or backs, they started down the staircase. The descent seemed endless. The red light grew brighter. The stench of Atropos grew thicker. And Ralph was aware that they were both going up as they went down. It was either that or be flattened by the smell. He continued telling himself that they were doing what they had to do, and that there must be a timekeeper on an operation this big, someone who would give them a poke if and when the schedule got too tight for comfort. But he kept worrying just the same, because there might not be a timekeeper, or an ump, or a team of refs in zebra-striped shirts.
"All bets are off," Clotho had said.
Just as Ralph was starting to wonder if the stairs went all the way down into hell itself, they ended. A short, stone-lined corridor, no more than 40 inches high and 20 feet long, led to an arched doorway. Beyond it, that red glow pulsed and flared like the reflected glow of an open oven. "Come on, Lois, but be ready for anything. Be ready for him." She nodded, hitched at her wayward slip again, then walked beside him up the narrow passage. Ralph kicked something that wasn't a stone and bent over to pick it up. It was a red plastic cylinder, wider at one end than at the other. After a moment, he realized what it was. A jump rope handle. 369, hun. The goose drank wine.
"Don't butt into what doesn't concern you, short time," Atropos had said.
But he had butted in, and not just because of what the little bald doctors called Ka, either. He had gotten involved because what Atropos was up to was his concern. Whatever the little creep might think to the contrary, Derry was his town, Lois Chass was his friend, and Ralph found within himself a sincere desire to make Doc Number 3 sorry he'd ever seen Lois's diamond earrings. He flipped the jump rope handle away and started walking again. A moment later, he and Lois passed under the arch and simply stood there, staring into Atropos's underground apartment. With their wide eyes and linked hands, they looked more like children in a fairy tale than ever. Not Peter Pan and Wendy now, but Hansel and Gretel, coming upon the witch's candy house after days spent wandering in the trackless forest.
"Oh, Ralph! Oh, my God, Ralph! Do you see?"
"Shh, Lois, shh." Directly ahead of them was a small, mean chamber, which seemed to be a combination kitchen and bedroom. The room was simultaneously sordid and creepy. Standing in the center was a low, round table, which Ralph thought was the amputated top half of a barrel. The remains of a meal, some gray, rancid gruel that looked like liquefied brains congealing in a chipped soup tureen, stood on it. There was a single dirty folding chair. To the right of the table was a primitive commode, which consisted of a rusty steel drum with a toilet seat balanced on top of it. The smell rising from this was incredibly foul. The room's only decoration was a full-length brass-boarded mirror on one wall, its reflective surface so age-darkened that the Ralph and Lois captured within it looked as if they might have been floating in 10 or 12 feet of water. To the left of the mirror was a stark sleeping accommodation, which consisted of a filthy mattress and a burlap sack stuffed with straw or feathers. Both pillow and mattress glowed and raved with the night sweats of the creature who used them. "The dreams inside that burlap pillow would drive me insane," Ralph thought. Somewhere, God only knew how much farther under the earth, water was dripping hollowly. On the far side of the apartment was another, higher arch, through which they could see a jumbled, surreal storage area. Ralph actually blinked 2 or 3 times to try to make sure he was really seeing what he thought he was seeing. "This is the place, all right," he thought. "Whatever we came to find, it's here." Lois began to drift toward this second arch as if hypnotized. Her mouth was quivering with dismay, but her eyes were full of helpless curiosity. It was the expression, he was quite sure, that must have been on the face of Bluebeard's wife when she had used the key which unlocked the door to her husband's forbidden room. Ralph was suddenly sure that Atropos was lurking just inside that arch with his rusty scalpel poised. He hurried after Lois and stopped her just before she could step through. He grasped her upper arm, then put a finger to his lips and shook his head at her before she could speak. He hunkered down with the fingers of one hand tented on the packed dirt floor, looking like a sprinter awaiting the crack of the starter's gun. Then he launched himself through the arch, relishing the eager response of his body even at this moment, hitting on his shoulder and rolling. His feet struck a cardboard box and knocked it over, spilling out a jumble of stuff. Mismatched gloves and socks, a couple of old paperbacks, a pair of Bermuda shorts,
a screwdriver with smears of maroon stuff, maybe paint, maybe blood, on its steel shaft. Ralph got to his knees, looking back toward Lois, who was standing in the doorway and staring at him with her hands clasped under her chin. There was no one on either side of the archway, and really no room for anyone. More boxes were stacked on either side. Ralph read the printing on them with a kind of bemused wonder. Jack Daniels, Gilby's, Smirnoff, J&B. Atropos, it seemed, was as fond of liquor cartons as anyone else who couldn't bear to throw anything away. Ralph, is it safe? The word was a joke, but he nodded his head and held out his hand. She hurried toward him, giving her slip another sharp upward yank as she came, and looking about herself in growing amazement. Standing on the other side of the arch, in Atropos's grim little apartment, this storage area had looked large. Now that they were actually in it, Ralph saw it went well beyond that. Rooms this big were usually called warehouses. Aisles wandered among great, tottery piles of junk. Only the stuff by the door had actually been boxed. The rest had been piled any which way, creating something which was two parts maze and three parts booby-trap. Ralph decided that even warehouse was too small a word. This was an underground suburb, and Atropos might be lurking anywhere within it. And if he was here, he was probably watching them. Lois didn't ask what they were looking at. He saw by her face that she already knew. When she did speak, it was in a dreamy tone that sent a chill scampering up Ralph's back. He must be so very old, Ralph. Yes, so very old. 20 yards into the room, which was lit with the same sunken, sourceless red glow as the stairway, Ralph could see a large spoked wheel lying atop a cane-backed chair, which was, in turn, standing on top of a splintery old clothes press. Looking at that wheel brought a deeper chill. It was as if the metaphor his mind had seized to help grasp the concept of car had become real. Then he noted the rusty iron strip which circled the wheel's outer circumference and realized it had probably come from one of those gay 90s bikes that looked like overgrown tricycles. It's a bicycle wheel, all right, and it's 100 years old if it's a day, he thought. That led him to wonder how many people, how many thousands or tens of thousands, had died in and around Derry since Atropos had somehow transported this wheel down here. And of those thousands, how many had been random deaths? And how far back does he go? How many hundreds of years? No way of telling, of course. Maybe all the way to the beginning, whenever or however that had been. And during that time, he had taken a little something from everyone he had fucked with. And here it all was. Here it all was. Ralph! He looked around and saw that Lois was holding out both hands. In one was a Panama hat with a crescent bitten from the brim. In the other was a black nylon pocket comb, the kind you could buy in any convenience store for $1.29. A ghostly glimmer of orange-yellow still clung to it, which didn't surprise Ralph much. Each time the comb's owner had used it, it must have picked up a little of that glow from both his aura and his balloon string, like dandruff. It also didn't surprise him that the comb should have been with McGovern's hat. The last time he'd seen those two things, they'd been together. He remembered Atropos's sarcastic grin as he swept the Panama from his head and pretended to use the comb on his own bald dome. And then he jumped up and clicked his heels together. Lois was pointing at an old rocking chair with a broken runner. The hat was right there, on the seat. The comb was underneath it. It's Mr. Wiser's, isn't it? Yes. She held it out to him immediately. You take it. I'm not as ditzy as Bill always thought, but sometimes I lose things. And if I lost this, I'd never forgive myself. He took the comb, started to put it into his back pocket, then thought how easily Atropos had plucked it from that same location. Easy as falling off a log it had been. He put it into his front pants pocket instead,
then looked back at Lois, who was gazing at McGovern's bitten hat with the sad wonder of Hamlet looking at the skull of his old pal Yorick. When she looked up, Ralph saw tears in her eyes. He loved this hat. He thought he looked very dashing and debonair when he had it on. He didn't. He just looked like Bill, but he thought he looked good. And that's the important part. Wouldn't you say so, Ralph? Yes. She tossed the hat back into the seat of the old rocker and turned to examine a box of what looked like rummage sale clothes. As soon as her back was to him, Ralph squatted down, peering beneath the chair, hoping to see a splintered double gleam in the darkness. If Bill's hat and Joe's comb were both here, then maybe Lois's earrings. There was nothing beneath the rocker but dust and a pink knitted baby bootie. Should have known that it'd be too easy, Ralph thought, getting to his feet again. He suddenly felt exhausted. They had found Joe's comb with no trouble at all, and that was good, absolutely great. But Ralph was afraid it had also been a spectacular case of beginner's luck. They still had Lois's earrings to worry about, and doing whatever else it was they had been sent here to do, of course. And what was that? He didn't know. And if someone from upstairs was sending instructions, he wasn't receiving them. Lois, do you have any idea what... Shh! What is it? Lois, is it him? No. Be quiet, Ralph. Be quiet and listen. He listened. At first he heard nothing, and then the clenching sensation, the blink, came inside his head again. This time it was very slow, very cautious. He slipped upward a little farther, as lightly as a feather lifted in a draft of warm air. He became aware of a long, low, groaning sound, like an endlessly creaking door. There was something familiar about it, not in the sound itself, but in its associations. It was like a burglar alarm, or maybe a smoke detector. It's telling us where it is. It's calling us. Lois seized his hand with fingers that were as cold as ice. That's it, Ralph. That's what we're looking for. Do you hear it? Yes, of course he did. But whatever that sound was, it had nothing to do with Lois's earrings. And without Lois's earrings, he wasn't leaving this place. Come on, Ralph. Come on, we have to find it. He let her lead him deeper into the room. Atropos's souvenirs were piled at least 3 feet higher than their heads in most places. How a shrimp like him had managed this trick, Ralph didn't know. Levitation, maybe. But the result was that he quickly lost all sense of direction as they twisted, turned, and occasionally seemed to double back. All he knew for sure was that low groaning sound kept getting louder in his ears as they began to draw near its source. It became an insectile buzzing, which Ralph found increasingly unpleasant. He kept expecting to round a corner and find a giant locust staring at him, with dull brownish-black eyes as big as grapefruit. Although the separate auras of the objects which filled the storage vault had faded like the scent of flower petals pressed between the pages of a book, they were still there beneath Atropos's stench. And at this level of perception, with all their senses exquisitely awake and attuned, it was impossible not to sense those auras and be affected by them. These mute reminders of the random dead were both terrible and pathetic. The place was more than a museum or a pack rat's lair, Ralph realized. It was a profane church where Atropos took his own version of communion. Grief for bread, tears for wine. Their stumbling course through the narrow zigzag rows was a gruesome, almost shattering experience. Each not quite aimless turn presented 100 more objects Ralph wished he had never seen and would not have to remember. Each voiced its own small cry of pain and bewilderment. He did not have to wonder if Lois shared his feelings. She was sobbing steadily and quietly beside him. Here was a child's battered, flexible flyer sled with a knotted tow rope still draped over the steering bar. The boy to whom it had belonged had died of convulsions on a crisp January day in 1953. Here was a majorette's baton with its shaft wrapped in purple and white spirals of crepe, the colors of Grant Academy. She had been raped and bludgeoned to death with a rock in the fall of 1967. Her killer, who had never been caught, had stuffed her body into a small cave where her bones, along with the bones of two other unlucky victims, still lay. Here was the cameo brooch of a woman who'd been struck by a falling brick while walking down Main Street to buy the new issue of Vogue. If she had left her home 30 seconds earlier or later, she would have been fine. Here was the buck knife of a man who had been killed in a hunting accident in 1937. Here was the compass of a Boy Scout who had fallen and broken his neck while hiking on Mount Katahdin. The sneaker of a little boy named Gage Creed, run down by a speeding tanker truck on Route 15 in Ludlow. Rings and magazines, keychains and umbrellas, hats and glasses, rattles and radios. They looked like different things, but Ralph thought they were really all the same thing. The faint, sorrowing voices of people who had found themselves written out of the script in the middle of the second act, while they were still learning their lines for the third. People who had been unceremoniously hauled off before their work was done, or their obligations fulfilled. People whose only crime had been to be born in the random, and to have caught the eye of the madman with the rusty scalpel. Lois, sobbing, "I hate him. I hate him so much." He knew what she meant. It was one thing to hear Clotho and Lachesis say that Atropos was also part of the big picture, that he might even serve some higher purpose himself, and quite another to see the faded Boston Bruins cap of a little boy who had fallen into an overgrown cellar hole and died in the dark, died in agony, died with no voice left after 6 hours spent screaming for his mother. Ralph reached out and briefly touched the cap. Its owner's name had been Billy Weatherby. His final thought had been of ice cream. Ralph's hand tightened over Lois's. "Ralph, what is it? I can hear you thinking, I'm sure I can, but it's like listening to someone whisper under his breath." "I was thinking that I want to bust that little bastard's chops for him, Lois. Maybe we could teach him what it's like to lie awake at night. What do you think?" Her grip on his hand tightened. She nodded. They reached a place where the narrow corridor they'd been following branched into diverging paths. That low, steady buzz was coming from the left-hand one, and not very far up it either, by the sound. It was now impossible for them to walk side by side, and as they worked their way toward the end, the passage grew narrower still. Ralph was finally obliged to begin sidling along. The reddish exudate Atropos left behind was very thick here, dripping down the jumbled stacks of souvenirs and making little puddles on the dirt floor. Lois was holding his hand with painful tightness now, but Ralph didn't complain. "It's like the Civic Center, Ralph. He spends a lot of time here." Ralph nodded. The question was, what did Mr. A come down this aisle to commune with? They were coming to the end now. It was blocked by a solid wall of junk, and he still couldn't see what was making that buzzing sound. It was now starting to drive him crazy. It was like having a horsefly trapped in the middle of your head. As they approached the end of the passage, he became more and more sure that what they were looking for was on the other side of the wall of junk which blocked it. They would either have to retrace their steps and try to find a way around, or break through. Either choice might consume more time than they could afford. Ralph felt nibbles of desperation at the back of his mind. But the corridor did not dead-end. On the left there was a crawl space beneath a dining room table piled high with dishes and stacks of green paper and... green paper? No, not quite. Stacks of bills. Tens, twenties, and fifties were piled up in random profusion on the dishes. There was a choke of hundreds in a cracked gravy boat, and a rolled-up $500 bill poking drunkenly out of a dusty wine glass. "Ralph, my God, it's a fortune!" She wasn't looking at the table. but at the other wall of the passageway. The last 5 feet had been constructed of banded gray-green bricks of currency. They were in an alleyway which was literally made of money, and Ralph realized he could now answer another of the questions that had been troubling him: where Ed had been getting his dough. Atropos was rolling in it, but Ralph had an idea that the little bald-headed son of a bitch still had trouble getting dates. He bent down a little to get a better look into the crawl space underneath the table. There appeared to be yet another chamber on the other side, this one very small. A slow red glow waxed and waned in there like the beating of a heart. It cast uneasy pulses of light on their shoes. Ralph pointed, then looked at Lois. She nodded. He dropped to his knees and crawled beneath the money-laden table and into the shrine Atropos had created around the thing which lay in the middle of the floor. It was what they had been sent to find. He hadn't a single doubt about it, but he still had no idea what it was. The object, not much bigger than the sort of marbles children call croakers, was wrapped in a death bag as impenetrable as the center of a black hole. Oh, great! Lovely! Now what? Ralph, do you hear singing? It's very faint. He looked at her dubiously, then glanced around. He had already come to hate this cramped space, and although he was not claustrophobic by nature, he now felt a panicky desire to get away, squeezing into his thoughts. A very distinct voice spoke up in his head. It's not just what I want, Ralph. It's what I need. I'll do my best to hang in with you, but if you don't finish whatever the hell it is you're supposed to be doing in here soon, it won't make any difference what either of us want. I'm just going to take over and run like hell. The controlled terror in that voice didn't surprise him, because this really was a horrible place. Not a room at all, but the bottom of a deep shaft whose circular walls were constructed of rickrack and stolen goods, toasters, footstools, clock radios, cameras, books, crates, shoes, rakes. Dangling almost right in front of Ralph's eyes was a battered saxophone on a frayed strap with the word Jake printed on it in dust-dulled rhinestones. Ralph reached out to grab it, wanting to get the damn thing out of his face. Then he imagined the removal of this one object starting a landslide that would bring the walls down on them, burying them alive. He pulled his hand back. At the same time, he opened his mind and senses as fully as he could. For a moment, he thought he did hear something. A faint sigh, like the whisper of the ocean in a seashell. But then it was gone. If there are voices in there, I can't hear them, Lois. That damn thing is drowning them out. He pointed at the object in the middle of the circle. Black beyond any previously held conception of black. A death bag which was the apotheosis of all death bags. But Lois was shaking her head. No, not drowning them out. Sucking them dry. She looked at the screaming black thing with horror and loathing. That thing is sucking the life out of all this stuff piled up around it. And it's trying to suck the life out of us, too. Yes, of course it was. Now that Lois had actually said it out loud, Ralph could feel the death bag, or the object inside it, pulling at something far down in his head, yanking at it, twisting at it, shoving at it, trying to pull it out like a tooth from its pink socket of gum. Trying to suck the life out of them? Close, but no cigar. Ralph didn't think it was their lives the thing inside the death bag wanted, nor their souls, at least not exactly. It was their life force it wanted. Their ka. Lois's eyes widened as she picked up this thought, and then they shifted to a place just beyond his right shoulder. She leaned forward on her knees and reached out. Lois, I wouldn't do that. You could bring the whole place down around our... Too late. She yanked something free, looked at it with horrified understanding, and then held it out to him. It's still alive. Everything that's in here is still alive. I don't know how that can be, but it is. Somehow it is. But they're faint. Why are they so faint?
What she was holding out to him was a small white sneaker that belonged to a woman or a child. As Ralph took it, he heard it singing softly in a distant voice. The sound was as lonely as November wind on an overcast afternoon, but incredibly sweet as well, an antidote to the endless bray of the black thing on the floor. And it was a voice he knew. He was sure it was. There was a maroon splatter on the sneaker's toe. Ralph at first thought it was chocolate milk, then recognized it for what it really was, dried blood. In that instant, he was outside the Red Apple again, grabbing Nat before Helen could drop her. He remembered how Helen's feet had tangled together, how she had stumbled backward, leaning against the Red Apple's door like a drunk against a lamppost, holding out her hands to him.
Give me my baby. Give me Ali.
He knew the voice because it was Helen's voice. This sneaker had been on her foot that day, and the drops of blood on the toe had come either from Helen's smashed nose or from Helen's lacerated cheek. It sang and sang, its voice not quite buried beneath the buzz of the thing in the death bag. And now that Ralph's ears, or whatever passed for ears in the world of auras, were all the way open, he could hear all the other voices of all the other objects. They sang like a lost choir. Alive. Singing. They could sing. All the things lining these walls could sing, because their owners could still sing. Their owners were still alive. Ralph looked up again, this time noting that while some of the objects he saw were old, the battered alto sax, for instance, a great many of them were new. There were no wheels from gay 90s bicycles in this little alcove. He saw 3 o'clock radios, all of them digital, a shaving kit that looked as if it had hardly been used, a lipstick that still had a Rite Aid price tag on it. Lois, Atropos has taken this stuff from the people who'll be at the Civic Center tonight, hasn't he? Yes, I'm sure that's right. He pointed at the black cocoon shrieking on the floor, almost drowning out the songs all around it, drowning them out as it fed on them. And whatever's inside that death bag has something to do with what Clotho and Lachesis called the master cord. It's the thing that ties all these different objects, all these different lives, together. That makes them quartet. Yes. Ralph handed the sneaker back to Lois. This goes with us when we go. It's Helen's. I know. Lois looked at it for a moment, then did something Ralph thought extremely clever. Pulled out 2 eyelets worth of lacing and tied the sneaker to her left wrist like a bracelet. He crawled closer to the small death bag and then bent over it. Getting close was hard, and staying close was harder. It was like placing your ear next to the motor housing of a power drill shrieking at full volume, or looking into a bright light without squinting. This time there seemed to be actual words buried within that buzzing, the same ones they'd heard as they approached the edge of the death bag around the Civic Center.
Girl, fuck off! Beat it!
Ralph placed his hands over his ears for a moment, but of course that did no good. The sounds weren't coming from the outside, not really. He let his hands drop again and looked at Lois. What do you think? Any ideas on what we should do next? He didn't know exactly what he had expected of her, but it wasn't the quick, positive response he got. Cut it open and take out what's inside, and do it right away. That thing's dangerous. Also, it might be calling Atropos. Have you thought of that? Tattling, just like the hen tattled on Jack in the story about the magic beanstalk. Ralph actually had considered this possibility, although not in such vivid terms. All right, he thought. Cut open the bag and take the prize. Except just how are we supposed to do that? He remembered the bolt of lightning he'd sent at Atropos when the little bald creep had been trying to lure Rosalie across the street. A good trick, but something like that might do more harm than good here. What if he vaporized the thing they were supposed to take? I don't think you can do that.
All right, fair enough. As a matter of fact, he didn't think he could do it either. But when you were surrounded by the possessions of people who could all be dead when the sun came up tomorrow, taking chances seemed like a very bad idea. An insane idea. What I need isn't lightning, but a nice, sharp pair of scissors, like the ones Clotho and Lachesis used to... He stared at Lois, startled by the clarity of the image. I don't know what you just thought of, but hurry up and do it, whatever it is. Ralph looked down at his right hand, a hand from which the wrinkles and the first twists of arthritis had now disappeared, a hand which lay inside a bright blue corona of light. Feeling a little foolish, he folded his last two fingers against his palm and extended the first two, thinking of a game they'd played as kids. Rock breaks scissors, scissors cut paper, paper covers rock. Be scissors, he thought. I need a pair of scissors. Help me out. Nothing. He glanced at Lois and saw her looking at him with a serene calm, which was somehow terrifying. Oh, Lois, if you only knew, he thought, and then swept that out of his mind, because he had felt something, hadn't he? Yes, something. This time he didn't make words in his mind, but a picture. Not the scissors Clotho had used to send on Jimmy V, but the stainless steel shears from his mother's sewing basket. Long, slim blades tapering to a point almost as sharp as the tip of a knife. As he deepened his concentration, he could even see the two tiny words engraved on the metal just south of the pivot point. Sheffield Steel. And now he could feel that thing in his mind again. Not a blink this time, but a muscle. An immensely powerful one, slowly flexing. He looked fixedly down at his fingers and made the shears in his mind open and close. As they did, he slowly opened and closed his fingers, creating a V that widened and narrowed. Now he could feel the energy he had taken from Nirvana Boy and the bum out at the train yards, first gathering in his head and then moving down his right arm to his fingers like a cramp. The aura surrounding the extended first and second fingers of his right hand began to thicken and to lengthen, to take on the slim shape of blades. Ralph waited until they had extended themselves about 5 inches out from his nails, and then worked his fingers back and forth again. The blades opened and closed. Go, Ralph, do it! Yes, he couldn't afford to wait around and run experiments. He felt like a car battery that had been called on to crank a motor much too big for it. He could feel all his energy, the stuff he'd taken as well as his own, running down his right arm and into those blades. It wouldn't last long. He leaned forward, fingers pressed together in a pointing gesture, and sank the tip of the scissors into the death bag. He'd been concentrating so hard on first creating and then maintaining the scissors that he had stopped hearing that steady, hoarse buzz, at least with his conscious mind. But when the scissors' point sank into its black skin, the death bag suddenly cycled up to a new shrieking pitch of mingled pain and alarm. Ralph saw dribbles of thick, dark goo running out of the bag and across the floor. It looked like diseased snot. At the same time, he felt the power drain inside him roughly double. He could see it, he realized. His own aura running down his right arm and across the back of his hand in slow, peristaltic waves. And he could sense it dimming around the rest of his body as its essential protection of him thinned out. Hurry, Ralph, hurry! He made a tremendous effort and tore his fingers open. The shimmering blue blades also opened, making a small slit in the black egg. It screamed, and two bright, jagged flashes of red light raced across its surface. Ralph brought his fingers together and watched the shears growing from their tips snap shut, cutting through dense black stuff that was part shell and part flesh. He cried out. It was not pain he felt exactly, but a sense of awful weariness. This is what bleeding to death must feel like, he thought. Something inside the bag gleamed bright gold. Ralph gathered all his strength
and attempted to open his fingers for another cut. At first, he didn't think he was going to be able to do it. They felt as if they'd been stuck together with crazy glue. And then they drew apart, widening the slit. Now he could almost see the object inside, something small and round and shiny. Really, only one thing it can be, he thought. And then his heart suddenly fluttered in his chest. The blue blades flickered. Lois, help me! She seized his wrist. Ralph felt strength roar into him in big, fresh volts. He watched, bemused, as the shears solidified again. Now only one of the blades was blue. The other was a pearly gray. Lois screaming inside his head, cut it! Cut it now! He brought his fingers together again, and this time the blades cut the death bag wide open. It uttered one last wavering shriek, turned entirely red, and disappeared. The shears growing from the tips of Ralph's fingers flickered out of existence. He closed his eyes for a moment, suddenly aware that big warm drops of sweat were running down his cheeks like tears. In the dark field behind his eyelids, he could see crazy afterimages that looked like dancing scissors blades. Lois, are you okay? Yes, but drained. I don't have the slightest idea how I'm supposed to get back to those stairs under the tree, let alone climb them. I'm not sure I can even stand up. Ralph opened his eyes, put his hands on his thighs above the knees, and leaned forward again. Lying on the floor where the death bag had been was a man's wedding ring. He could easily read what had been engraved on the wide inner curve. H.D. E.D. 8587. Helen Deepnow and Edward Deepnow, married on August 5th, 1987. It was what they had come for. It was Ed's token. All that remained now was to pick it up, slip it into the watch pocket of his pants, find Lois's earrings, and get the hell out of here. As he reached for the ring, a flicker of verse slipped through his mind. Not Stephen Dobbins this time, but J.R.R. Tolkien, who had invented the hobbits Ralph had last thought of in Lois's cozy, picture-filled living room. It had been almost 30 years since he had read Tolkien's story of Frodo and Gandalf and Sauron the Dark Lord, a story which contained a token very similar to this one, now that he thought about it. But the lines were momentarily as clear as the scissors blades had been only moments before. One ring to rule them all, one ring to find them, one ring to bring them all, and in the darkness bind them, in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie. I won't be able to pick it up, he thought. It will be as tightly bound to the wheel of car as Lois and I are, and I won't be able to pick it up. Either that, or it will be like grasping a live high-tension wire, and I'll be dead before I know it's happening. Except he didn't really believe either of those things was going to happen. If the ring was not his for the taking, why had it been protected by the death bag? If the ring was not his for the taking, why had the forces which stood behind Clotho and Lachesis, and Dorrance, he couldn't forget Dorrance, set him and Lois upon this journey in the first place? One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them, Ralph thought, and closed his fingers around Ed's wedding ring. For a moment, he felt a deep, glassy pain in his hand and wrist and forearm. At the same moment, the softly singing voices of the objects, which Atropos had hoarded here, rose in a great harmonic shout. Ralph made a sound, perhaps a scream, perhaps only a moan, and lifted the ring up, clenched tightly in his right hand. A sense of victory sang in his veins like wine, or like... Ralph! He looked at her, but Lois was looking down at where Ed's ring had been, her eyes dark with a mixture of fear and confusion. Where Ed's ring had been, where Ed's ring still was, it lay exactly as it had lain, a glimmering gold circlet with H.D. E.D. 8587 inscribed around the inner arc. Ralph felt an instant of dizzy disorientation and controlled it with an effort. He opened his hand, half expecting the ring to be gone in spite of what his senses told him. But it still lay in the center of his palm, neatly enclosed within the fork where his love line and his lifeline diverged, glimmering in the baleful red light of this nasty place. HD ED 8587. The two rings were identical. One in his hand, one on the floor. Absolutely no difference. At least none that Ralph could see. Lois reached for the ring which had replaced the one Ralph had picked up, hesitated, then grasped it. As they watched, ghost gold glowed just above the chamber's floor, then solidified into a third wedding band. Like the other two, HD ED 8587 was inscribed on the inner curve. Ralph found himself thinking of yet another story, not Tolkien's Long Tale of the Ring, but a story by Dr. Seuss, which he had read one of Carolyn's sister's kids back in the 50s. That was a long time ago, but he had never completely forgotten the story, which had been richer and darker than Dr. Seuss's usual jingle-jangle nonsense about rats and bats and troublesome cats. It was called The 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins, and Ralph supposed it really wasn't any wonder that the story had come to mind now. Poor Bartholomew was a country hayseed who had the bad luck to be in the big city when the king happened by. You were supposed to take your hat off in the presence of that august personage, and Bartholomew had certainly tried, but without any luck. Each time he took his hat off, another one, identical to the last, appeared beneath it. "Ralph, what's happening? What does it mean?" He shook his head without answering, eyes moving from the ring on his palm to the one in Lois's hand to the one on the floor, around and around and around. Three rings, all of them identical, just like the hats Bartholomew Cubbins had kept trying to take off. The poor kid had gone on trying to make his manners to the king, Ralph remembered, even as the executioner had led him up a curving flight of stairs to the place where he would be beheaded for the crime of disrespect. Except that wasn't right, because after a while, the hats on poor Bartholomew's head did begin to change, to grow ever more fabulous and rococo. "And are the rings the same, Ralph? Are you sure?" No, he guessed he wasn't. When he'd picked up the first one, he'd felt a deep, momentary ache spread up his arm like rheumatism. But Lois had shown no signs of pain when she picked up the second one. And the voices, I didn't hear them shout when she picked up the one she has. Ralph leaned forward and grasped the third ring. There was no jolt of pain and no shout from the objects which formed the walls of the room. They just kept singing softly. Meanwhile, a fourth ring materialized where the other three had been. Materialized exactly like another hat on the head of hapless Bartholomew Cubbins. But Ralph barely glanced at it. He looked at the first ring, lying between the fork line of his lifeline and love line on the palm of his right hand. One ring to rule them all, he thought. One ring to bind them. And I think that's you, beautiful. I think the others are just clever counterfeits. And maybe there was a way to check that. Ralph held the two rings to his ears. The one in his left hand was silent. The one in his right, the one that had been inside the death bag when he cut it open, gave off a faint, chilling echo of the death bag's final scream. The one in his right hand was alive. Ralph? Her hand on his arm, cold and urgent. Ralph looked at her, then tossed the ring in his left hand away. He held the other up and gazed at Lois's strained, strangely young face through it, as if through a telescope. This is the one. The others are just placeholders, I think, like zeros in a big, complicated math problem. You mean they don't matter? He hesitated, unsure of how to reply. Because they did matter, that was the thing. He just didn't know how to put his intuitive understanding of this into words. As long as the false rings kept appearing in this nasty little room, like hats on the head of Bartholomew Cubbins, the future represented by the death bag around the Civic Center remained the one true future. But the first ring, the one which Atropos had actually stolen off Ed's finger, perhaps as he lay sleeping next to Helen in the little Cape Cod house which was now standing empty, could change all that. The replicas were tokens which preserved the shape of Carr, just as spokes radiating out from a hub preserve the shape of a wheel. The original, however, Ralph thought the original was the hub. One ring to bind them. He gripped the gold band tightly, feeling its hard curve bite into his palm and fingers. Then he slipped it into his watch pocket. There was one thing about Carr they didn't tell us, he thought. It's slippery. Slippery as some nasty old fish that won't come off the hook, but just keeps flopping around in your hand. And it was like climbing a sand dune, too. You slid one step back for every two you managed to lunge forward. They had gone out to High Ridge and accomplished something. Just what, Ralph didn't know. But Dorrance had assured them it was true. According to him, they had fulfilled their task there. Now they had come here and taken Ed's token. But it still wasn't enough. And why? Because Carr was like a fish. Carr was like a sand dune. Carr was like a wheel that didn't want to stop, but only to roll on and on, crushing whatever might happen to be in its path. A wheel of many spokes. But most of all, perhaps, Carr was like a ring. Like a wedding ring. He suddenly understood what all the talk on the hospital roof and all of Dorrance's efforts to explain hadn't been able to convey. Ed's undesignated status, coupled with Atropos's discovery of the poor, confused man, had conveyed a tremendous power upon him. A door had opened, and a demon called the Crimson King had strolled through, one that was stronger than Clotho, Lachesis, Atropos, any of them. And it didn't intend to be stopped by a dairy old croc like Ralph Roberts. Ralph, one ring to rule them all, Lois. One ring to find them. What are you talking about? What do you mean? He patted his watch pocket, feeling the small yet momentous bulge that was Ed's ring. Then he reached out and grasped her shoulders. The replacements, the false rings, are spokes, but this one is the hub. Take away the hub, and a wheel can't turn. Are you sure? He was sure, all right. He just didn't know how to do it. Yes, now come on. Let's get out of here while we still can. Ralph sent her beneath the overloaded dining room table first, then dropped to his knees and followed. He paused halfway under and looked back over his shoulder. He saw a strange and terrible thing. Although the buzzing sound had not returned, the death bag was re-knitting itself around the replacement wedding ring. Already the bright gold had dimmed to a ghostly circlet. He stared at it for several seconds, fascinated, almost hypnotized, then tore his eyes away with an effort and began to crawl after Lois. Ralph was afraid they would lose valuable time trying to navigate their way back through the maze of corridors which crisscrossed Atropos's storehouse of keepsakes. But that turned out not to be a problem. Their own footprints, fading but still visible, were there to guide them. He began to feel a little stronger as they put the terrible little room behind them. But Lois was now flagging badly. By the time they reached the archway between the storehouse and Atropos's filthy apartment, she was leaning on him. He asked if she was all right. Lois managed a shrug and a small, tired smile. Most of my problem is being in this place. It doesn't really matter how high up we go. It's still foul, and I hate it. Once I get some fresh air, I think I'll be fine, honestly. Ralph hoped she was right. As he ducked under the arch into Atropos' apartment, he was trying to think of a pretext by which he could send Lois on ahead of him. That would give him an opportunity to give the place a quick search. If that didn't turn up the earrings, he would have to assume that Atropos was still wearing them. He noticed her slip was hanging below the hem of her dress again, opened his mouth to tell her, and saw a flicker of movement from the tail of his left eye. He realized they had been a lot less cautious on the return trip, partly because they were worn out, and now they might have to pay a high price for dropping their guard. "Lois, look out!" Too late. Ralph felt her arm jerked away as the snarling creature in the dirty tunic seized her about the waist and dragged her backward. Atropos's head only came to her armpit, but that was enough to allow him to hold his rusty blade over her. When Ralph made an instinctive lunge at him, Atropos brought the straight razor down until it was touching the pearl-gray cord which drifted up from the crown of her head. He bared his teeth at Ralph in an unspeakable grin.
"Not another step, Shorts! Not one!"
Well, he didn't have to worry about Lois's errant earrings anymore, at least. They glittered a murky pinkish red against the tiny lobes of Atropos's ears. It was more the sight of them than the shout that stopped Ralph where he was. The scalpel drew back a little, but only a little.
"Now, Shorts, you took something of mine just now, didn't you? Don't try to deny it. I know. And now you're going to give it back."
The scalpel returned to Lois's balloon string. Atropos caressed it with a flat of the blade.
"You give it back, or this bitch is going to die here in front of you. You can stand there and watch the sack turn black. So what do you say, Short Stuff? Hand it over!"